Well, it's my very pleasant honor to introduce Preston Manning. I've known Preston since I think he was about, as we say in these parts, knee-high to a grasshopper, way back in the early days of his life, and have watched with great respect and admiration the tremendous talent of this Canadian statesman. And indeed, he is a statesman, a person who brings thoughtful, incisive analysis, ideas to the forefront in a variety of ways, and has given a service to his country that few indeed could even begin to match. All of this done with respect for some very important principles in his life. Well, I would like to say, if there's one word that describes my feeling about Preston Manning, it's the word proud. So proud of what he has done and the highly capable way that it's been carried out. Well, a person introducing should give some of the backgrounds that are known to some and not to all, and I would like to touch on, albeit briefly, some of the particular accomplishments. It's fair to start with what is a significant accomplishment in many households, and particularly in the Mannings, and that is his wife Sandra, who has been such a supportive and indeed a co-leading role in many of Preston's activities. A wonderful lady, and I don't know where you are, Sandra, but I hope you're out there. You better be. Okay. They have been married for 38 years, and it's appropriate because Preston's love of family, along with his participation in politics, is his life. They have 5 children, 8 young grandchildren, and they do alternate their place of residence between Calgary and Toronto. Preston was born in Edmonton, and throughout his adolescent and teen years, he lived and worked on a farm, which in this part of the country is a first step in the admiration process. And amongst other things, I understand he actually milked cows many a day out there, so we'll keep that in mind if we need any help on the milk supply here today. He graduated from the University of Alberta with a degree in economics. Prior to entering federal politics, between 1968 and 1988, Preston owned and operated an Edmonton-based research and management consulting firm that specialized in long-range strategic planning, including, by the way, appropriate to this conference and his talk, communications planning. In both the private sector and in his political career, Preston Manning has demonstrated a strong commitment to democratic principles, the value of private enterprise economy, and active social responsibility. He is a senior fellow of the Fraser Institute, a fellow of the Canada West Foundation, a distinguished visitor in Canadian public policy at the University of Calgary, and the Dean's Distinguished Visitor in Political Science and Canadian Studies at the University of Toronto. He is particularly interested in bridging the communications gap between scientific and political communities. Now, just a quick calling of the roll. He's been there and done a lot of that, as the saying goes. From 1987 to 2002, very active in federal political politics. He was a principal founder of the Reform Party of Canada and the Canadian Conservative Reform Alliance in 2000. He was elected to the House of Commons in 1993, re-elected in 1997 and 2000. He served as leader of the Reform Party from 1987 to 2000. Leader of the opposition in Parliament from 1997 to 2000, an opposition critic for science and technology, note that, from 2000 to 2001. I say as an aside, he's also a highly valued member of the Board of Trustees of the Manning Awards Foundation, and like all our trustees and selection committee members, he donates his time and talents. They're all volunteers working for a better Canada. Preston has consistently and with great dedication advanced the principles of fiscal responsibility, including, sounds almost strange these days, balanced budgets and controlled spending. My, oh my, if more of our political leaders would just act on some of those fundamentals. He believes, too, in social responsibility with a focused government commitment to strengthening the family and protecting the life and property of citizens. And he deeply believes in democratic accountability, including reform of federal institutions like the House of Commons, the Senate, and the Supreme Court, so that they are more representative and democratically accountable to the Canadian people, and a rebalancing of responsibilities between the federal and provincial governments. Preston is the author of two Canadian bestsellers, The New Canada in 1992 and Think Big, My Adventures in Life and Democracy in 2002. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to welcome to this podium a wonderful friend, a great statesman, and someone who does so much from Canada, Preston Manning.
Well, I'd like to say thank you for that kind introduction. David didn't mention that my first job on the farm was actually driving a manure spreader, which some people suggested qualified me for my later line of work. So thank you, David, for missing that. It's just great to be here with you. Jasper's got great memories for Sandra and I. This hotel is a special hotel. Walter Twin, the chief of the Sawridge, had this. The Sawridge Band is one of the unique bands in Alberta. It's one of the wealthiest bands per capita. There's less than 100 people in the band. Walter's great-grandfather settled up at Lesser Slave Lake about 150 miles north of Edmonton and happened to pick a spot where there was oil and gas. And Walter was one of the few Indian chiefs in Alberta that decided to parlay that wealth into a bunch of businesses. This was one of them. So it's a special place, and it's got quite a history to it. Jasper itself has memories for us. Joe Clark used to represent this Yellowhead riding. It's a magnificent riding, stretches from just west of Edmonton right to the BC border. A huge riding. I ran against Joe here in 1988, and we had a scheme. I had a bunch of my supporters were from Edson, which is cowboy country, and they got a scheme where Joe was going to come in on a train, one of those tourist trains from BC, and we put a posse together. We were going to arrest Joe at the station here for failure to represent Yellowhead in the federal parliament. It was one of the issues between us. And you had to smuggle the horses into the park because the park's people weren't too keen about that. So we managed to get him in over there behind the Jasper Park Lodge. We had the railway guys were in on it. They were going to call us on their walkie-talkie when Joe's train came across the highway out here. And this more work went into this than into my entire campaign. And then something went wrong. This always happened to Joe. Something went wrong with the train in BC, and it never arrived. So we were riding around Jasper with these signs with Joe Clark wanted for something, and Japanese tourists taking our pictures. We couldn't carry off our holdup of the train. We got it was a communications disaster. I don't know why I'm telling you this, because this will really inspire your confidence, but we got no publicity in the Canadian papers, but we did get two mentions in Tokyo. So I did just want to also say just a special thank you to Dave Mitchell for his very kind introduction. But where Dave and I actually got together was years and years ago, I guess over 25 years ago. David was head of Alberta Energy Company and called our consulting firm and mentioned to me that he wanted to set up a foundation to provide rewards for scientific innovators, and not at the end of their careers, but at the front end, when maybe getting some money and some attention might actually help their careers. He wanted our firm to kind of come up with the scheme for setting up this foundation, its governance, and so forth. He wanted my father's input, who'd retired from provincial politics at that time, but didn't want him to know that this thing would probably be named after him when it was set up. So I presented to my father as here's a client wants to set up this foundation, and managed to get a lot of his input. We went over to see the Nobel Foundation to see how they had set up, particularly the investment side of it. It was one of the highlights of our work together, and we've got this all together, and David and his people ended up bringing this thing into being, and my father thought it was being done for somebody else. He thought it was being done for Alberta Energy Company, and he was quite surprised when they ended up naming it after him. So David's been a long time support, and want to thank him for his support of scientific innovation in this country. And the companies that he's been connected with, of course, Alberta Energy and now Encana, which is the largest oil and gas company, petroleum company in the country, has been financially supportive of this type of effort. Just want to pay tribute to that, David. I think Encana and yourself put your money where your mouth is on communication as science, and I'm sure that'll be appreciated by the folks here. Now, I want to start with just a couple of truisms that I think we'll all agree on, but I want to jump to some conclusions from them. And first of all, to say that I think all of us here agree that science is one of the dominant forces and influences in society, that the scientific method has become one of the chief mechanisms for solving problems and generating knowledge, that science is the principal driver of the new economy, and that science, its worldview, its methods, its conclusions now permeate virtually everything that we do as a society. I think we'd also agree that more and more political issues are science-based. Environmental issues, climate change, many health issues, stem cell research, cloning, assisted human reproduction, genetically modified foods, biotech, the list of political issues which Parliament and legislatures are concerned that have a science base either to define the problem or to define the solution is getting longer and longer. And yet, notwithstanding all of that, there's a big gap between the knowledge of the science community and public understanding of science, and a huge gap between the worldviews and knowledge bases of the political communities and the scientific community. The principal means of bridging these gaps, of course, is better communication. Your specialty, your art form, your business, your profession, and better communication between the science worlds and the non-science world. One of the keys to better communications is just to better understand the gap between those two worlds and the various efforts of people on both sides, both what succeeds and what fails, to bridge them. So what I'd like to do this morning is share some stories and observations with you from my experience of communication between the political and the scientific world, in the hope that these may in some small sense illustrate the gap or the problem, suggest some solutions, and most importantly just try to stimulate some questions and some discussion a little later on. To illustrate how communications completely dominates the modern political business, consider this. If you're trying to persuade a caucus, a legislative caucus, whether it's in Ottawa, doesn't matter what party it is, or in one of the provincial capitals, to take a position on something, whether it's health care, taxes, or Iraq, or an environmental position, or whatever, if they can't see within about 30 seconds how to communicate the position you're trying to get them to take, either directly and through the media, that position is in trouble and is unlikely to be accepted no matter what its other merits are. The communicability of positions, policy positions, and messages has become a higher priority in most political circles than its constitutionality, its economic implications, its social implications, its administrative feasibility, and even its morality. Communicability of the message. And what this means is that science presentations to the political community have to be put in a politically communicable form if they're going to have an impact or have a chance of carrying the judgment of the audience. And what this usually involves is finding hooks
in the psyche or the experience of the politicians, the media, and the public to which the scientific message can be related. And that's not always easy because the hooks that work with that audience are not hooks that naturally occur and flow from the scientist's method of thinking. Just on this subject, I teach a course one semester a year at the University of Toronto on public policy in the genetic revolution. I bring in experts on genetic science, life sciences, and I make the public policy connections, the implications for health policy, intellectual property law, bioterrorism, and so forth. And I've got these students imagining that they are legislative assistants to a harried MP who doesn't ever has time to go and listen to these briefings. So he sends them to it, and they have to come back to the harried MP who's worried about flooding his constituency and the vote next Tuesday in the House and all sorts of other things, and communicate to me what Dr. So-and-so said on plant genetics and genetically modified food, or what Dr. So-and-so said about the application of genetic science to curing inheritable diseases, et cetera, et cetera. And the hardest thing for them to understand, my class is split between political science pre-law students and half of them are pure science students, biology students, life science, is that they got to get my attention. I keep telling them, I'm not like your regular professor. I don't have to read anything that you write to me. I got no time. You know, give me an oral briefing. Leave me a piece of paper, but give me the oral briefing. And it's hardest for the science students to realize they got to get a hook. They got to get my attention in 30 seconds, or they've lost me. And it's interesting how after the first couple of times, when they get over the idea that I don't have to read or listen to anything they're saying, that they got to win my attention, that some of them get very good. And one of the best ones just this last time was this girl came in and said, "What did you eat for breakfast this morning?" Which surprised me that she would ask that. And I told her what I'd eaten, and she got into how much genetically modified food I just ingested. That was her hook. But that finding the hook. A few years ago, I tried to get, I actually did get, a group of MPs to go up to Chalk River to look at the proposal for a neutron generator, a neutron reactor that Atomic Energy was trying to push with the, get funding from the federal government. I had difficulty even getting them to go up there, partly because they all knew in the end of the day it was a pitch for money. This is another subject we could get into. The link between the science and political community, it shouldn't always be starting with money. There's other ways of getting the connection so that you can get around the money. But anyway, I managed to get a few of them going up there. And we got a presentation on the need for that neutron generator by a very eminent Canadian physicist who obviously knew what he was talking about. And he explained this whole thing basically the way that it occurred to him. And he started out with sort of physics 101. What was a neutron? You know, what is a reactor? What is a neutron beam? What is a neutron beam generate? Then he got into the explanation of how this thing would work if they could build it. And then he got into the applications and took everyone out to the laboratory where they were doing some testing. They didn't actually have a neutron beam, but were they doing some materials testing with some other machines. And in the course of showing people different things they were testing, he mentioned just casually, and here's a piece of the O-ring from the Saturn vehicle, and here's this, and here's that. And then he got to the sales pitch. And you see the sequence of thinking, the physics 101, the explanation, the application, a couple of illustrations, and then the sales pitch. I said to a couple of the atomic energy people afterwards that this is none of my business, but if I was putting on this show, here's how I would communicate this to my colleagues. I would not start with physics 101. I'd take them into your video viewing room, and I'd show the Saturn vehicle blowing up, and I'd have one big word on the screen, stress. And I'd stress kill, stress cost, and I'd have the Firestone tire blowing up, and I'd have a bridge collapsing, and I'd have lots of stress crushing things. We get their attention with the stress. And then I'd get into, you know, what stress is, the physicist is a few molecules that are supposed to hang together, didn't hang together. And what this machine is we're trying to build here is something to study that phenomenon. And then I'd get into my physics 101 because I got their attention. Finding the hook and finding the hook that works with the audience that you're dealing with. Just another illustration of this. When the human genome sequencing was being completed, in Ottawa they had that eggheads and bacon breakfast, where the scientists are the eggheads, and that shows who the politicians are, the bacon. And this presentation, they had these lunch or breakfast, once a month, and bring in a scientist to talk about some contemporary subject, and we try and get a bunch of the MPs, often more of their staff, that are interested to come and get briefed. And one of these was set up with Dr. Tom Hudson from McGill, who'd been doing work on the Human Genome Project. The sequencing was just about completed. And it was felt this is something that's got enormous implications for public policy, particularly on the health side and the research side, and the MPs should get interested in it. A number of us thought we'd take advantage of Tom being there, but to get a special meeting with him after to get into this in some depth. So a couple of us undertook to round up as many MPs as we could. There was 300 MPs in the House at that time. We identified about 100 who might have some interest in this subject, or you could make some connection to it. We got on the phone with them, sent them messages, emails. This is MPs trying to get other MPs. This isn't some outside outfit trying to get them into something. This is MPs with some science interest trying to get the others to cover up. We ended up getting 20 out of the 300, which kind of tells you something. This was towards the end of the sequencing. It was all over the papers now, but we got 20. Anyway, we got 20, and the briefing actually went quite well. Tom and some other geneticists and medical people got into the whole implications of the genome, explained the thing. The communications at the front end in this presentation went quite well, had the attention of the people, so much to the point where some of the MPs started to open up about some of the health problems in their own constituents that started out, and then it got into their own families. We've got Alzheimer's in our family. We've got diabetes in ours. These are part of the inheritable diseases that Tom had been talking about, and hopefully genetic therapies might. Some of them got quite explicit about that. And could this help, or would this help, or what would be the implications, et cetera, et cetera. Now, what I was doing was watching the scientists that were there and some of their assistants that were there, and I noticed that not one of them was taking a note. Like what those MPs had just given him, it was an open window into their hearts and lives, a hook. And you don't want to exploit people's experience with disease, but I think you should make a little note about it. Like that MP is worried about Alzheimer's for some very personal and family reasons. And the next time you want to make a pitch to him about what this science might do, maybe it wouldn't hurt to remember that. What I know is from my lobbying days or my consulting days back in the consulting business, if that had been an oil patch bunch making that presentation, and some MP said, look, my grandfather was involved drilling for oil with Imperial Oil at Leduc, that would have, a note would have been made of that. That would have got into a database. And the next time that guy was there trying to make a pitch, he'd say, remember your uncle worked for Imperial Oil back at Leduc? It's a bridge. And I guess what I'm saying here is that the scientists in this situation needed help in interpreting the feedback they were getting from an effective communication making sure it got into their understanding of the background of this audience so that the next time the communication was made, it was even more effective. Often the hook, I think, for science projects is the people, not the project. And this, I don't know whether this will be useful to some of you, particularly some of you involved in the communications work for science projects, but you should think through the traditional visit of the politician to the science project. Often these things happen all the time. The scientists are involved, or the politicians are involved to come to see some science project, the nanotechnology thing, say, that's being set up at the University of Alberta, big, huge amount of federal funding, provincial funding, private funding into that project. So they ask the politicians to come on and see our project. And many of these presentations are very standard, and they're not as effective as they could be. Politicians arrive, half the time or three-quarters of the time is spent on the physical. Come and see our building. Come and see the facilities. Come and see the machines. And that's all. I'm not saying that's not interesting. And to some people, it's more than interesting. And then, oh, by the way, here's some of our people. Here's Dr. So-and-so who's doing this. Here's graduate student so-and-so who's doing that. Often this is tacked on in the end. Often it's done very casually. The politicians know what, they're not name tags even. There's no clear idea what is scientist so-and-so. But when you think about it, the strength of those projects is the people. And the most interesting part about it is the people. And if those politicians go away from that project, it's not important that they know how to find the NINT project at the U of A. What's important is some relationship built up with some of those people. I know MPs that will go to bat for a particular scientist, and they don't hardly know what the guy's doing, but because they're so impressed with the individual and their dedication to what they're doing. So I think in those types of situations, a better approach is make the scientists, the people, the focus on the stars. What are they doing? Aim to establish a relationship with the people. And you want to see the facility and the machinery too, but it's the people that are important. If you wanted to use a hockey analogy, if you were inviting somebody, we were originally Edmonton people. I ended up representing a Calgary constituency, but always cheered for the Oilers and sorry to say this, see if I'm going to get in trouble. Cheer for the Oilers and the Eskimos. That used to lose me about 300 votes a game when the Eskimos would play the Stampeders in Calgary. If I used to go with a ball cap and dark glasses and cheer for the other side. But if you were taking a group of people back in the glory days of the Oilers to see the setups and say there were people you were trying to get to buy season tickets or to invest or something, sure you'd show them the Northlands Coliseum and sure you'd show them the ice-making machine. It's some of the best in North America. But wouldn't you make the highlight of the visit, the meeting the players, chance to shake Gretzky's hand? I think that emphasis is we need a little bit more of that in the promotion of science. Now, another thing I'd like to get on to, I'm just jumping around, but I'm basically try to get stories that might illustrate to you some of the problems and challenges of this political science communication. One of the key aspects of communicating political messages, and I suppose this is true of any message, especially to large numbers of people, is timing. Waiting for the wave on which you can launch your communication surfboard. Waiting for the, trying to find an updraft in which you can put your kite, because it'll go a lot higher than if you just throw it out there. No matter what. It's all a matter of detecting the waves and detecting the updrafts and getting your communication into those things. For example, the older people remember the weeks immediately after the successful launch of Sputnik was a great opportunity to talk to people about the need for more engineering and money in that area in astrophysics. The weeks after the SARS problem was raging, you've had public audiences extremely receptive to epidemiology and anything that had to do with that. This January, you had the whole world open to understanding the geophysics of tsunamis because there was literally a wave in that case. And riding the wave requires us to be attuned to the big movements in culture and public interests, and flexible in our communication so that we can design a communications piece that'll ride that wave or catch that updraft. And to illustrate that with respect to Alberta, where you're visiting and we're celebrating 100th anniversary, Alberta is a wave waiting to be ridden in certain scientific areas. And I'll come at it from the political end, but it's got a science connotation. Alberta is not a province like all the others when it comes to provincial politics. As long periods of one-party government, only four administrations in 100 years, it has these long periods of one-party government, then it has an upheaval, a big revolution, throw everybody out of the legislature and start over again. This is the Alberta democracy. And in this province, no government has ever been replaced by its traditional opposition. It has always been replaced so far, and maybe that can change, by a new group with a big idea. So if you're, and the current government's been around for 34 years, it may get a new lease on life, because if you're the governing party, what you do is try and capture the new idea yourself and remake yourself as the new thing. But there's going to be changes here provincially, either within the provincial existing governing party or perhaps something new come out of the woodwork. So there's a discussion going around in this province of what's the next wave going to be? And what's the next big idea that's going to capture Albertans? And there's various candidates for it. But one of the ideas that's a candidate, and no one can say for sure, this may not be true, but it might be, is if someone could marry a genuine commitment to conservation with Alberta's traditional commitment to marketplace economics, if you could marry conservation and small-c conservative, they both come from the same root, incidentally, conservation, conservative. And the conceptual framework is, there's some interesting links there. That could be one of the next big waves that'll hit this province. Lots of evidence of that. The formation of all kinds of environmental groups in this province over the last 10, 15 years. If you add up the memberships of environmental groups, their memberships, their budgets, the number of people that attend their meetings, they would exceed the total memberships, total budgets, and the total number of people attending all political meetings of all parties in this province probably by 8 to 10 times. Now, they're not politicized, but if someone were to politicize them, that would be a very formal force. On the public opinion polls, the top-of-mind issue polls in Alberta, environment, conservation, and right under health care is the number two issue for the last 4 years. The Green Party, in my old constituency, Calgary Southwest, got 11%. This is Alberta. People don't, particularly people from other parts of the country, do not understand that in this province, particularly in the southwest corner, for example, you've got those ranchers. What are those ranchers? Rock-ribbed fiscal conservatives who've resisted federal intervention in their industry probably more than any other section of the agriculture community, but fanatically committed to the preservation of their lands. What are those guys? You know, blue environmentalists or green conservatives? What are they? They've integrated in their heads this thing, and there's other groups throughout the province. And the reason I say this is if one was interested in environmental science or communicating environmental science, particularly on the big issues here, the boreal forest, what to do with the tar sands environmentally, how can you marry that, and the water issues in the south, huge issues, big meetings to discuss them, conventions being held. Oil companies and gas companies spending a lot more money and time on that than many of the governments in other parts of the country. Interest groups being formed in that area. If one has any kind of scientific message connected with environmental science, there's a wave here that you could ride to get to 2 to 3 million people if one was attuned to it. Now, there are, of course, I want to try and now get at this subject of communication between politicians and scientists at a more fundamental level. You all know that there are models, scientific models, of how information and ideas and messages get from one person's head to another. One of the simplest and the oldest ones is the old source message receiver model. You have a source that's the generator of the message. The source has certain grids it puts the message through, that shapes it, the vocabulary, the thought patterns, whatever, but a message comes out of the source. There's a media that carries the message. The media might be you. There's a receiver, and the receiver also has a bunch of grids in front of them. And, of course, the challenge is if the grids of the receiver and the grids of the source were the same, it would be very easy, but often they aren't, and particularly if it's the political source and the scientific receiver or vice versa. Lots of challenges to the media to translate the message so it gets through. All of this communication occurs in a context. It never occurs in a vacuum in which there's hundreds of other messages being bombarded at the receiver. You know, this source message receiver is a simple model. And I, for example, in that model, practice what is called receiver-oriented communication. This is very appropriate to democratic politicians. Not all politicians do this because they aren't all democratic. There's hierarchical. But if you're a Democrat, you will be a receiver-oriented communication. So when I make a speech or a presentation, particularly to a public audience, I have clearly in mind an objective that I want to achieve and the response I want to generate in my audience. But I do not start my communication planning or presentation outline with my objectives or my preferences as to what I want to say in the way that I want to say it, and in the using the media that I am most comfortable and familiar with. I start, as a receiver or a communicator, with my audience. Who are these people? What? Why did they come to this meeting? What are their attitudes? What do they think about me before they ever got here that I've either got to correct or reinforce? What are their values? What are their filters? What is their vocabulary? I just look quickly at a public audience. Are there older people there? I better speak slower and more distinctly because older people have trouble hearing. Simple things like that. Some of them are more profound. What media do they like? How do they like to receive messages? How would they express my message if they understood it and were communicating it to someone else? I've got a whole communications planning thing they used to go through to do this. If my audience is an electronic media person and they ask me a question, I know that in the end I have 10 to 15 seconds to give the precise answer and then add relevant facts, explanations, and arguments as long as I can get away with it. If I start with the relevant facts, arguments, explanations, etc., to set up my answer so that it now makes some sense to them, I've lost most of those media, particularly in a scrum outside the House of Commons. You've got 10 to 15 seconds to make your point. If your point registers the answer to the question, you may buy yourself more time to elaborate on it. If you elaborate first and try to get, because that might be your natural way of doing it. I want to give you the framework, and I want to give you the facts, and I want to give you the background. I've studied this thing to death, and then we'll get to the conclusion. The guy, you've lost the guy. He's gone somewhere else. Now, I don't know if we can do this, but Bob McDonald did an interview on Quirks and Quarks the other day that indicated, so I'd say I'm a receiver-oriented communicator. There are many people who are source-oriented communicators. And particularly if we are the source of the message ourselves and consider ourselves authoritative sources, then our instinct is to communicate in the ways that occur to us, in the words that occur to us, and how the message formulated first in our minds, to use our analogies and so forth. And many scientists are like that. They communicate in the method. They communicate in the method, basically, of the scientific method. They let the information out, basically, the way the scientific method delivered it to them. And if we've got that, our sound guy, can you stick in that interview? But we haven't had a chance to try this out, so this may not work. But Bob McDonald did an interview with a scientist on Quirks and Quarks where he asked a question, and I thought it was just a great illustration of how there's nothing wrong with this explanation. It's a very good scientific explanation that works very well with an audience that's attuned to it. But you'll notice the flow of how this answer is given. Do you want to stick that? Now this is a great interview. I mean, it certainly held my interest, and I'm sure it did the audience, and I'm sure the young person that asked the question, it satisfied. It was logical, it was well articulated, and it was an acceptable approach to communicating the answer from a scientific standpoint. And if you look at the message pattern, you see it had a broad, if I had a board here, it had a broad front. It's like a triangle. The front was broad. It started out with an explanation and all the facts and some arguments, and then it narrowed down to the answer, which was 150,000. You could be 150,000 kilometers closer before frying the Earth. But you'll notice that it took 125, I was timing it here, it took 125 seconds to get to that point. And if we listen to the rest of it, it then broadened out again. Having made that point, it went on again with more explanation. It made even more sense once you got to the 150,000. But my only point in this is to illustrate how different that is from the way a politician is trained and inclined to answer the question, which is to get to the precise answer 150,000 kilometers as fast as you can in the first 10 to 15 seconds, and then to trail all that other stuff out after if you can keep the interest of the interviewer or the audience. That the politician has a narrow front end on the response, and it broadens out like that. She had a broad front end, narrowing and then broadening out again. And the difference between the politician's response and the scientist's response is almost like the difference between an ice cube and an iceberg. like, you know, the iceberg, you got the tip of the iceberg sitting above the water and all this stuff underneath, which is extremely important. You wouldn't even have the tip. Politicians get so used to just giving the tip that it ends up getting disconnected from anything else. You can skate through 90% of the scrums outside the House of Commons just having the tip, because no one's got time to ask you more about it, which is actually a very dangerous mode of thinking. People that I don't mind people talking in sound bites. When they start thinking in sound bites, they can only think in little chunks. You got big trouble. And in fact, I would argue that's part of what's wrong with this country, but that's another subject. Okay, now you can see what happens when receiver-oriented communicators, like many politicians, meet source-oriented communicators, like many scientists. Like, there's lots of room for misunderstanding. The receiver-oriented approach is repugnant to a lot of scientists. It's too superficial. Trying to make them start with the conclusion and work their way back is exactly the opposite, the way their own head works. Politician having them sit through all the explanation and background at the beginning, he's sitting there trying to get what's the answer to the question which I asked you. Answer the question and then I'll determine whether I listen to the rest of it. That is what is going on in many meetings between scientific and political people. And the challenge is sort of to bridge that gap, which is the challenge of the science communicator, who's often in the middle. Okay, well, what can we do to bridge the gap? Just a couple of suggestions. I think the communication staffs of science organizations and political offices can help. A lot can be done to pre-test science messages being delivered to political receivers and vice versa, and to teach effective follow-up. Some scientists are good communicators, and those people should be identified and stuck out in front because they make a lot of yards. Art MacDonald of the Neutrino Project, I find, a very effective communicator. And I'm sure there's many others, but he's just one that happened to be impressing me. He also has a very effective technique. He takes you down 2 kilometers down to the bottom of that shaft, wander around to get to that neutrino detector, and I think it's 1/4 mile from the bottom of the shaft. It's dark as pitch. You're all disoriented. And he says, before I take you out, I'd like to ask whether you're in favor of funding neutrino. So I think I am. Secondly, we need many more and better intermediaries. Science communicators and media like you, who can day after day in 100 different ways via the various media raise the general level of understanding on both sides. Intermediaries who particularly can raise the general understanding of science issues with the public, whom actually both these types of communicators ultimately are trying to influence. I've always been struck by the fact that the word media and the word mediator come from the same root. And I can think of no more important and meaningful role in the scientific age than that of being a mediator between sources and receivers of scientific method. And a mediator is not someone that is particularly arguing from the one or trying to present it from the source angle or trying to present it from the receiver angle. It's someone that actually assumes both of them are legitimate. The mediator, media person, is trying to reconcile source to receiver. And I couldn't think of a more important function in our age. There's also a longer-term solution that might help us all. There are people in Canada and in the world who specialize in the science of communication. But one of the difficulties I used to find in the consulting business of getting scientists even to listen to the idea of planning their communications is that they don't have a lot of respect for communications people. They think they're all old newspaper guys and hacks and flacks. And they say, they're not scientists. You don't understand. How many times? You don't understand because you're not one of us. But there is such a thing as a science of communication. There are psychologists, there are cognitive neurologists who study how does a signal get from one person's head, how does it get from their brain to their mouth, and how does it get from their mouth into your head, and how does it get processed. There are electronics people who study communications from an electronic standpoint, but they have models and things that are quite relevant to communication. There's cultural anthropologists who make a living out of studying those grids that are in front of the receiver and in front of the sources. And if the grids are different, how do you get messages across cross-cultural grids? There's a whole science of communication. And so I would like to suggest, in addition to the other things I've said, that someone should launch a project to examine the application of the science of communication to the communication of science. Application of the science of communication to the communication of science. And I think some conclusions that came out of it, many of which would reinforce some of the things that you are doing as communications people anyway, but when it comes with a scientific base, it might get more receptivity, particularly from the science community. Now, I've exceeded my time, so just one last thing. And this is a special challenge to Canada's science communicators. When I look ahead at some of the challenges that will face us in the future, particularly at the science-political interface, there's one special challenge which I think will demand all the science communication skills and resources that this country can muster. Of all the experts that I have come to talk to my class on public policy and the genetic revolution at U of T, the ones that worry me the most, particularly as a political person, are the ones that describe the inevitability of a pandemic, like SARS or avian flu or some mutated virus, on a massive scale. You've seen, you know, those types of presentations. They're pretty scary. And these people no longer say if, they say when. And the other thing that scares me is sort of related to it, is the very real danger that some of these marvelous advances in life sciences and medical science that are intended to try to reduce disease can be twisted by some deranged mind into biological weapons with immense potential for harm. Now, experts from both these points of view point out that while a pandemic or a bioterrorist attack has a specific and immediate health-related impact on the people that it directly affects, the greatest damage will be done not by the pandemic or the bioterrorist activity itself, but by the transmission through the general population of the fear, panic, and terror that a pandemic or a terrorist attack triggers. The biggest danger is not the actual incident. The bigger danger is the one that gets transmitted, the fear, the panic, the terror, that's the objective of terrorism, that, to the general population. How is that fear, panic, terror transmitted to the population at large? Not through the air, not through the water, not through some utility system, the New York water system, or some ecosystem, but through another network, the mass communication network of society itself, in particular television, the print media, radio, and the internet, reinforced by word-of-mouth communication. How prepared our mass media, in particular our science communicators, are in advance to discharge their public responsibilities in these situations will be critical to the outcome. How well informed the public is in advance of a particular biohazardous event will be critical to the outcome. How the media, in particular our science communicators, transmit the facts, the emotions, the images associated with such events, when they actually occur, will be crucial to the outcome. Whether the media and the communicators become the principal carriers of the fear and the panic and the terror associated with pandemics or bioterrorist acts, or the principal carriers of the antibodies of fact and reason that will attenuate and mitigate the fears and the panic, will be one of the most critical challenges facing science communicators, in my judgment at least, in the decade ahead. It seems to me that the preparations, the knowledge, and the skills of our science communicators could very well be the factor that determines whether Canada and the world meet this challenge successfully or whether we don't meet it successfully. I have every confidence that you will rise to the occasion, but the issue, I think, needs to be put squarely on the table in Canada in front of associations like yours to discuss on some other occasion, debated, discussed, and resolved, and the sooner the better. Anyway, those are a few thoughts on communications between politicians and scientists, and I'd be more than happy to try to answer any questions that you have or to listen to comments that you might have in the time that's remaining. Thank you very much.